dust-to-dust routine. Cheap wooden casket, no vault. That was the way his grandfather was buried. Anyway, I was at the hospital when he died, and I waited for the mortician from Wiggins to arrive with the hearse. Rolland was his name, a real card. Owns the only funeral home in town. Black suit, the works. I gave him a copy of Clovis's instructions. The will gave me authority to do what needed to be done, and Rolland didn't care. It was around 3 in the afternoon. Rolland said he would do the embalming in a few hours. He asked me if Clovis had a suit to be buried in. We hadn't thought of that. I said no, I'd never seen Clovis in a suit. Rolland said he kept a few old ones around and he'd take care of it. Clovis wanted to be buried on his farm, but I explained to him many times that in Mississippi you can't do that. Has to be in a registered cemetery. His grandfather fought in the Civil War and had been quite the hero, according to Clovis. When he was 7 years old, his grandfather died, and they had one of those old-fashioned wakes that lasted for 3 days. They placed his grandfather's casket on a table in the front parlor, and folks trooped by and looked at him. Clovis liked that. He was determined to do something similar. He made me swear that I would do a small wake for him. I explained this to Rolland. He said something to the effect that he'd seen everything. This was no surprise. Just after dark, I was sitting on Clovis's front porch when the hearse pulled up. I helped Rolland roll the casket down the driveway. We manhandled it up the steps, over the porch, and into the den, where we parked it in front of the television. I remember thinking how light it was. Clovis had shriveled up to 100 pounds. "You the only one here?" Rolland said, looking around. "Yep, it's a small wake," I said. I asked him to open the casket. He hesitated, and I told him that I had forgotten to include some Civil War memorabilia that Clovis wanted to be buried with. While I watched, he opened the casket with his church key, a small generic wrench which will open any casket in the world. Clovis looked the same. On his waist I placed his grandfather's infantryman's cap and a tattered regimental banner from the 17th Mississippi. Rolland closed the casket again and left. No one showed up for the wake. Not a soul. I turned the lights off around midnight and locked the doors. Church keys are nothing more than Allen wrenches, and I had purchased a full set. It took less than a minute to open the casket. I removed Clovis. He was light, stiff as a board, and shoeless. I guess for $3,000 you don't get a pair of shoes. I laid him gently on the sofa, then I placed 4 concrete cinder blocks in the coffin and closed it. Clovis and I left and drove to my hunting cabin. He was lying in the back seat, and I was driving very carefully. It would have been difficult to answer questions from a highway patrolman. A month earlier, I had bought an old freezer and put it on the screen porch of the cabin. I had just managed to get Clovis stuffed in the freezer when I heard something in the woods. It was Pepper sneaking up on the cabin. 2 o'clock in the morning, and Pepper caught me. I told him my wife and I had just finished a big fight, I was in a foul mood, and would he please leave. I don't think he saw me wrestling the corpse up the steps of the cabin. I locked the freezer with log chains, put a tarp over it, then some old boxes. I waited until dawn, because Pepper was out there somewhere. Then I sneaked off, drove home, changed clothes, and was back at Clovis's by 10. Rolland arrived in a chirpy mood and wanted to know how the wake went. "Just perfect," I said. The grieving had been held to a minimum. We pushed and pulled and loaded the casket back into the hearse, then went to the cemetery. Carl listened with his eyes closed, his lips curled into a smile, his head shaking slowly in disbelief. "You devious bastard," he said almost to himself. "Thanks." On Friday afternoon I went to the cabin for the weekend. I worked on a brief, scouted turkeys with Pepper, checked on old Clovis, who seemed to be resting comfortably. Sunday morning I left before sunrise and positioned the dirt bike and the gasoline. Later I drove Pepper to the bus station in Jackson. After dark I removed Clovis from the freezer, sat him up next to the fireplace so he'd thaw, then around 10 put him in my trunk. An hour later I was dead.
"No remorse?"
"Of course. It was a terrible thing to do. But I made the decision to vanish, Carl, and I had to figure out a way. I couldn't kill anybody, but I needed a body. It actually makes sense."
"Perfectly logical."
And when Clovis died, it was time for me to leave. A lot of it was luck. So many things could have gone wrong.
Your luck continues.
So far? Carl looked at his watch and took another crab claw.
How much of this do I tell Judge Trussell?
Everything but Clovis's name. We'll save that for later. Chapter 40. Patrick sat at the end of the table. His space was clear, unlike his attorney to the right, who had two files and a short stack of legal pads arranged like weapons poised for battle. To his left sat T.L. Parrish, with only one legal pad, but also armed with a bulky tape recorder, which Patrick had allowed him to set up. No associates or flunkies to complicate things, but since all good lawyers need verifiers, they agreed to the taping. Now that the federal charges had disintegrated, the pressure was on the state to extract justice from Patrick. Parrish felt it. The feds had dumped this defendant on him so they could chase a senator, off to bigger things. But this defendant had new twists to add to the story, and Parrish was at his mercy. "You can forget capital murder, Terry," Patrick said. Though nearly everyone called him Terry, it grated a bit coming from a defendant he'd barely known years before in a prior life.
"I didn't kill anyone."
"Who burned in the car?"
"A person who had been dead for 4 days."
"Anybody we know?"
"No. It was an old person nobody knew."
"How did this old person die?"
"Old age."
"Where did this old person die of old age?"
"Here in Mississippi."
Parrish drew lines and made squares on his pad. The door had opened when the feds collapsed. Patrick was walking through it. No shackles, no handcuffs, nothing it seemed could stop him.
"So you burned a corpse?"
"That's correct."
"Don't we have a statute on that?"
Sandy slid a sheet of paper across the table. Parrish read it quickly and said,
"Forgive me, it's not something we prosecute every day."
"It's all you have, Terry," Patrick said, with all the cool confidence of someone who'd planned this meeting for years.
T.L. was convinced, but no prosecutor folded this easily.
"Looks like a year in jail," he said. "A year in Parchman should do you good."
"Sure, except that I'm not going to Parchman."
"Where do you plan to go?"
"Somewhere, and I'll get there with a first-class ticket."
"Not so fast. We have this body."
"No, Terry, you don't have a body. You have no clue who got cremated, and I'm not telling until we cut the deal."
"The deal being?"
"Drop the charges. Give it up. Both sides pack up and go home."
"Oh, that'll look nice. We catch the bank robber, he gives the money back, we drop the charges and wave goodbye to him. That'll send the right message to the other 400 defendants I have under indictment. I'm sure their lawyers will understand. A real shot in the arm for law and order."
"I don't care about the other 400, and they certainly don't care about me. This is the criminal process, Terry. It's every man for himself."
"But not everybody's on the front page."
"Oh, I see. You're worried about the press. When is re-election? Next year?"
"I'm unopposed." "I'm not too worried about the press."
"Of course you are. You're a public official. It's your job to be worried about the press, which is precisely the reason why you should dismiss the charges against me. You can't win. You're worried about the front page? Imagine your picture there after you lose."
"The family of the victim does not wish to press charges," Sandy said, "and the family is willing to go public." He lifted a piece of paper and waved it. The message was delivered. "We have the proof, we have the family, we know who they are, and you don't."
"That'll look good on the front page," Patrick said. "The family begging you not to prosecute."
"How much did you pay them?" he started to ask, then let it go. It was not relevant. More doodling on the legal pad. More appraising his sinking options as the tape recorder captured the silence.
With his opponent on the ropes, Patrick moved in for the knockout.
"Look, Terry," he said sincerely, "you can't prosecute me for murder. That's gone. You can't prosecute me for mutilating a corpse because you don't know who got mutilated. You have nothing. I know it's a bitter pill to swallow, but you can't change the facts. You'll take some heat, but hell, that's part of your job."
"Gee, thanks. Look, I can indict you for mutilating the corpse. We'll call him John Doe." Why not Jane Doe? Sandy asked. Whatever. And we'll pull the records of every old codger who died in early February of 1992. We'll go to the family, see if they've talked to you. We might even get a court order, dig up a few graves. We'll take our time. Meanwhile, you'll get transferred to the Harrison County Jail, where I'm sure Sheriff Sweeney will see the need to give you a few good cellmates. We'll oppose bail, and no judge will grant it because of your propensity to flee. Months will go by. Summer will come. The jail has no air conditioning. You'll lose some more weight. We'll keep digging, and with a little luck, we'll find the empty grave. And in exactly 9 months, 270 days after the indictment, we'll go to trial.
How are you going to prove I did it? There are no witnesses, nothing but some circumstantial evidence.
It'll be close, but you miss my point. If I drag my feet getting the indictment, I could add 2 months to your sentence. That's almost a year you'll spend in the county jail before trial. That's a long time for a man with plenty of money.
I can handle it, Patrick said, staring into Parrish's eyes, hoping he didn't blink first.
Maybe, but you can't run the risk of getting convicted.
What's your bottom line? Sandy asked.
You gotta look at the big picture, Parrish said, spreading his hands wide above his head. You can't make fools out of us, Patrick. The feds have hit the back door. The state doesn't have much left. Give us a notch for our belts, something.
I'll give you a conviction. I'll walk into a courtroom, face the judge, listen to your routine, and I'll plead guilty to the felony charge of mutilating the corpse. But I get no jail time. You can explain to the judge that the family does not want to prosecute. You can recommend a suspended sentence, probation, fines, restitution, credit for time served. You can talk about the torture and what I've been through. You can do all that, Parrish, and you'll look very good. Bottom line is this, no jail.
Parrish tapped his fingers and analyzed it.
And you'll reveal the name of the victim?
I will, but only after we have a deal.
We have authorization from the family to open the casket, Sandy said, waving another document briefly before returning it to the file.
I'm in a hurry, Terry. I have places to go.
I need to speak with Trussell. He'll have to approve this, you know.
He will, Patrick said.
Do we have a deal? Sandy asked.
As far as I'm concerned, we do,
Parrish said, then turned off the recorder. He gathered his weapons and stuffed them into his briefcase. Patrick winked at Sandy.
Oh, by the way, Parrish said as he stood. I almost forgot. What can you tell us about Pepper Scarborough?
I can give you his new name and social security number.
So he's still with us?
Yes. You can track him down, but you can't disturb him. He's done nothing wrong. The DA left the room without another word. Her 2 o'clock appointment was with a senior vice president of Deutsche Bank, London branch. He was a German with perfect English, an impeccably tailored navy double-breasted suit, rigid manners, and a fixed smile. He gazed for one split second at her legs, then got down to business. The wire from his bank, Zurich branch, would be for $113 million sent immediately to the America Bank, Washington branch. She had the account numbers and routing instructions. Tea and biscuits were brought in as he excused himself to have a private chat with Zurich. No problem, Miss Parrish, he said, smiling warmly now as he returned and took a biscuit for himself. She certainly hadn't expected any problems. His computer hissed with quiet efficiency, and a printout emerged. He handed it to her. After the wire, the balance in Deutsche Bank would be $1.9 million and change. She folded it and put it in her purse, a sleek new Chanel. Another Swiss account had a balance of $3 million. A Canadian bank on Grand Cayman held $6.5 million. A money manager in Bermuda was investing over $4 million for them, and $7.2 million was currently parked in Luxembourg, but was about to be moved. When her business was complete, she left the bank and found her car and driver parked nearby. She would call Sandy and pass along her next movements. Benny's stint as a federal fugitive was brief. His girlfriend spent the night in Frankfurt, then flew to London, landing at Heathrow around noon. Since they knew she was coming, the customs officer double-checked her passport and made her wait.
She wore dark sunglasses and her hand shook. It was all captured on video. At the cab stand, she was unknowingly detained by a policeman who appeared to be in charge of whistling for taxis. He asked her to stand over there, next to those other two ladies, while he worked the traffic. Her driver was a true cabbie, but only seconds earlier had been briefed and given a small radio. "Athenaeum Hotel on Piccadilly," she said. He eased away from the terminal in heavy traffic and nonchalantly gave the destination on the radio. He took his time. An hour and a half later, he deposited her at the door of the hotel. She waited again at the registration desk. The assistant manager apologized for the delay, but the computer was down. When word came that the phone in her room was adequately tapped, they gave her a key and a bellman took her away. She tipped him lightly, locked and chained her door, and went straight for the phone. The first words they heard her say were, "Benny, it's me, I'm here."
"Thank God," said Benny. "Are you okay?"
"I'm fine, just scared."
"Did anyone follow you?"
"No, I don't think so. I was very careful."
"Great. Look, there's a little coffee bar on Brick Street near Down, 2 blocks from your hotel. Meet me there in an hour."
"Okay. I'm scared, Benny."
"Everything's fine, dear. I can't wait to see you."
Benny wasn't at the coffee bar when she arrived. She waited for an hour before panicking and running back to her hotel. He didn't call, and she didn't sleep. The next morning, she gathered up the morning papers in the lobby and read them over coffee in the dining room. Deep in the Daily Mail, she finally found a 2-paragraph blip about the capture of an American fugitive, one Benjamin Arisia. She packed her bags and booked a flight to Sweden. Chapter 41. With Judge Carl Husky whispering into the ear of his colleague, Judge Henry Trussell, it was established that the Lanigan matter should take precedence until it was put to rest. Rumors of a deal were floating throughout the legal community in Biloxi, rumors chased and being chased by even more gossip about the poor Bogan firm. In fact, nothing else was being discussed in the courthouse. Trussell began the day by calling in T.L. Parrish and Sandy McDermott for a quick update, which eventually lasted for hours. Patrick was brought into the discussion on 3 occasions by use of Dr. Hayani's cell phone. The two, patient and doctor, were playing chess in the hospital cafeteria.
"I don't think he's cut out for jail," Trussell mumbled after the second call to Patrick.
He was visibly and verbally reluctant to let Patrick off the hook with such ease. But a conviction was a long shot. With a docket filled with drug dealers and child molesters, he wasn't about to waste time with a high-profile corpse mutilator. All the evidence was circumstantial, and given Patrick's current reputation for meticulous planning, Trussell doubted a conviction. The terms of the plea agreement were hammered out. The paperwork began with a joint motion to reduce the charges against Patrick. Then an agreed order to substitute new charges was prepared, followed by an agreed order accepting the guilty plea. In the course of the first meeting, Trussell spoke by phone to Sheriff Sweeney, Maurice Mast, Joshua Cutter, and Hamilton Janes in Washington. He also chatted twice with Carl Husky, who was next door just in case. The two judges, along with Parrish, were subject to voter recall every 4 years in the general election. Trussell had never had an opponent and considered himself politically immune. Husky was quitting. Parrish was sensitive. Though being a good politician, he presented the traditional facade of making the tough decisions without regard for public reaction. The three had been involved in politics for a long time, and each had learned a basic lesson. When contemplating an action which might be unpopular, do it quickly. Get it over with. Hesitation allows the issue to fester. The press grabs it, creates a controversy before the action, and certainly throws gasoline on the fire afterward. The Clovis issue was simple, once Patrick explained it to everybody. He would submit the name of the victim, along with authorization from the family to dig up the grave, open the casket, look inside. If it was in fact empty, then the plea agreement would be complete. Since there would always be doubt until they opened the grave, if by some chance the casket was occupied, then the plea agreement would be ripped up, and Patrick would still face capital murder charges. Patrick was supremely confident when he talked of the victim, and everyone believed without a doubt that the grave would be empty. Sandy drove to the hospital, where he found his client in bed, surrounded by nurses, as Dr. Hayani cleaned and dressed his burns. It was urgent, Sandy said, and Patrick apologized and asked them to leave. Alone, they walked through each motion and order, read every word aloud. Then Patrick signed his approval. Sandy noticed a cardboard box on the floor next to Patrick's temporary desk. In it were some of the books he'd loaned his client. The client was already packing. For Sandy, lunch was a quick sandwich at the hotel suite, eaten while standing and watching over the shoulder as a secretary retyped a document. Both paralegals and a second secretary were back in the office in New Orleans. The phone rang, and Sandy grabbed it. The caller identified himself as Jack Stefano from D.C. Maybe Sandy had heard of him. Yes, in fact, he had. Stefano was in the lobby downstairs and would like to talk for a few minutes. Certainly. Trussell had asked the lawyers to return around 2. They sat in the small den and looked at each other across a cluttered coffee table.
I'm here out of curiosity, Stefano said, and Sandy didn't believe him.
Shouldn't you start with an apology? Sandy said.
Yes, you're right. My men got a little carried away down there, and, well, they shouldn't have been so rough with your boy.
Is that your idea of an apology?
I'm sorry. We were wrong.
It lacked sincerity. I'll pass it along to my client. I'm sure it'll mean a lot to him.
Yes. Well, moving along here. I, of course, no longer have a dog in this fight. My wife and I are on our way to Florida for a vacation, and I wanted to take this little detour. I'll just be a minute.
Have they caught Aresia? Sandy asked.
Yes, just hours ago, in London.
Good.
I no longer represent him, and I had nothing to do with all that Platt and Rockland business. I was hired after the money disappeared. My job was to find it. I tried, I got paid, I've closed the file.
So why this visit?
I'm extremely curious about something. We found Lanigan in Brazil only after someone squealed on him. Someone who knew him very well. 2 years ago, we were contacted by an Atlanta firm called the Pluto Group. They had a client from Europe who knew something about Lanigan, and this client wanted money. We happened to have some at the time, and so a relationship developed. The client would offer us a clue, we would agree to pay a reward. The money changed hands, and the client was always accurate. This person knew an awful lot about Lanigan, his movements, his habits, his aliases. It was all a setup. There was a brain at work. We knew what was coming, and frankly, we were quite anxious. Finally, they popped the big one. For $1 million, the client would tell us where he lived. They produced some very nice photos of Lanigan, one washing his car, a Volkswagen Beetle. We paid the money. We got Lanigan.
So who was the client? Sandy asked.
That's my question. It's got to be the girl, right?
Sandy's reaction was delayed a bit. He grunted as if to laugh, but there was no humor in it.
It came back to him slowly, her story about using Pluto to monitor Stefano, who of course was searching for Patrick. Where is she now? Stefano asked.
I don't know, Sandy said. She was in London, but it was certainly none of his business.
We paid a total of $1,150,000 to this mysterious client, and she or he delivered, just like Judas.
It's over. What do you want from me?
As I said, I'm just curious. One of these days, if you learn the truth, I'd appreciate a call. I have nothing to gain or lose, but I won't rest well until I know if she took our money.
Sandy made a vague promise to perhaps one day give a call if he learned the truth, and Stefano left. Sheriff Raymond Sweeney got wind of the deal during lunch and didn't like it at all. He called Parrish and Judge Trussell, but both were too busy to talk to him. Cutter was out of the office. Sweeney went to the courthouse to be seen. He parked himself in the hallway between the judge's offices, so that if a deal was struck, he would somehow be in the middle of it. He whispered with the bailiffs and deputies. Something was coming down. The lawyers showed up around two with tight lips and solemn faces. They gathered in Trussell's office behind a locked door. After 10 minutes, Sweeney knocked on it. He crashed the meeting with a demand to know what was going on with his prisoner. Judge Trussell calmly explained that there would soon be a guilty plea, the result of a plea bargain, which in his opinion and in the collective opinions of everyone present was in the best interests of justice. Sweeney had his own opinion, which he readily shared.
It makes us look like fools. Folks out there are hot about this. You catch a rich crook and he buys his way out of jail. What are we, a bunch of clowns?
What do you suggest, Raymond? Parrish asked.
I'm glad you asked. First I'd put him in the county jail and let him sit for a while, same as all prisoners. Then I'd prosecute him to the fullest extent.
For what crime?
He stole the damn money, didn't he? He burned up that dead body. Let the boy serve 10 years in Parchman. That's justice.
He didn't steal the money here, Trussell explained. We have no jurisdiction. It was a federal matter, and the federal boys have already dismissed the charges. Sandy was in a corner, his eyes fixed on a document.
Then somebody screwed up, didn't they?
It wasn't us, Parrish said quickly.
That's great. Go sell that to the people who elected you. Blame it on the feds, because they don't run for office. What about burning the corpse? He gets to walk after admitting he did it?
You think he should be prosecuted for it? Trussell asked.
Damned right I do.
Good. How do you think we should prove our case? Parrish asked.
You're the prosecutor. That's your job.
Yeah, but you seem to know everything. Tell me, how would you prove the case?
He said he did it, didn't he?
Yeah. And do you think Patrick Lanigan will take the witness stand in his own criminal trial and confess to the jury that he burned a corpse? Is that your idea of trial strategy?
He won't, Sandy inserted helpfully. Sweeney's neck and cheeks were red, and his arms were flailing in all directions. He glared at Parrish, then at Sandy. And when he realized that these lawyers had all the answers, he brought himself under control.
When will this happen? He asked.
Late this afternoon, Trussell said. Sweeney didn't like this either. He stuck his hands deep in his pockets and headed for the door.
You lawyers, take care of your own, he said, just loud enough for everyone to hear. One big happy family, Parrish said, the sarcasm heavy.
Sweeney slammed the door and huffed down the hallway. He left the courthouse in his unmarked cruiser. Using his car phone, he called his own personal informant, a reporter with the Coast Daily. Since the family, such as it was, had given blanket approval, as had Patrick, the executor of the estate, the digging up of the grave was a simple matter. Judge Trussell and Parrish and Sandy didn't miss the irony of having Patrick, Clovis's only friend, sign an affidavit granting permission to open the casket so that Patrick could be cleared. Every decision seemed to be layered with irony. It was far different from an exhumation, a procedure that required a court order, after a proper motion and sometimes even a hearing. It was simply a look-see, a procedure unknown to the Mississippi Code, and therefore Judge Trussell took great latitude with it. Who could be harmed? Certainly not the family. Certainly not the casket. Evidently it was serving little purpose anyway. Rollins still owned the funeral home up in Wiggins. How well he remembered Mr. Clovis Goodman and his lawyer, and the odd little wake out there in the county at the home of Mr. Goodman, where no one showed up but the lawyer. Yes, he recalled it well, he told the judge on the phone. Yes, he'd read something about Mr. Lanigan, and no, he hadn't made the connection. Judge Trussell gave him a quick summary, which led immediately to Clovis's involvement in the plot. No, he had not opened the casket after the wake, and had no need to, never did in those situations. While the judge talked, Parrish faxed to Rolland copies of the consent signed by Dina Postel and by Patrick Lanigan, the executor. Rolland was suddenly eager to help. He'd never had a corpse stolen before. Folks just didn't do those things in Wiggins. And, well, yes, he could certainly have the grave opened in no time flat. He owned the cemetery, too.
Judge Trussell sent his law clerk and two deputies to the cemetery. Under the handsome headstone Clovis F. Goodman, January 23, 1907 to February 6, 1992, gone on to glory, a backhoe carefully picked through the loamy soil as Roland gave directions and waited with a shovel. It took less than 15 minutes to reach the casket. Roland and a helper stepped into the grave and shoveled away more dirt. The poplar had started to rot around the edges of the coffin. Roland straddled the lower half of the casket and with dirty hands inserted the church key. He jerked and pried until the lid made a cracking sound, then he slowly opened it. To no one's surprise, the casket was empty. Except, of course, for the four cinder blocks. The plan was to do it in open court, as required by law, but to wait until almost 5, when the courthouse was closing and many of the county employees were leaving. 5 o'clock sounded fine to everyone, especially to the judge and the district attorney, who were convinced they were doing the right and proper thing, but were nervous about it nonetheless. Throughout the day, Sandy had pushed hard for a quick disposal once the plea agreement had been reached and the casket opened. There was no reason to wait. His client was incarcerated, though this received little sympathy. The court was in the middle of a scheduled term. The timing was perfect. What could be gained by waiting? Nothing, His Honor finally decided. Parrish did not object. He had 8 trials scheduled over the next 3 weeks, and unloading Lanigan was a relief. 5 was most satisfactory for the defense. With a bit of luck, they could be in and out of the courtroom in less than 10 minutes. Another bit of luck, and no one would see them. 5 was perfect for Patrick. What else did he have to do? He changed into a pair of loose-fitting khakis and a large white cotton shirt. He wore new bass loafers, no socks because of the rope-burned ankle. He hugged Hayani and thanked him for his friendship. He hugged the nurses and thanked the orderlies and promised them all he'd be back soon to visit again. He wouldn't, and everyone knew it. After more than 2 weeks as a patient and prisoner, Patrick left the hospital, his lawyer at his side, his armed escorts following dutifully behind. Chapter 42. Evidently, 5 was a perfect time for everyone. Not a single courthouse employee left for home once word reached every corner of every office, a process that took only minutes. A real estate secretary for a large law firm was busy checking a land title in the office of the chancery clerk when she overheard the latest Patrick report. She raced to the phone and called her office. Within minutes, the entire legal community along the coast knew that Lanigan was about to plead guilty in some strange deal and would attempt to do so secretly at 5 in the main courtroom. The notion of a clandestine hearing to complete a backroom deal made for a frenzy of phone calls, calls to other lawyers, to wives, to favorite reporters, to partners out of town. In less than 30 minutes, half the city knew Patrick was about to make an appearance and a deal, and most likely walk. The hearing would have attracted less attention had it been advertised in the newspaper and posted on billboards. It was to be quick and secretive. Mystery engulfed it. It was the legal system protecting one of its own. They grouped in pockets of hushed gossip in the courtroom, whispering while watching people stream in and guarding their seats. The crowd grew and gave further credence to the hearsay. All these people couldn't be wrong. And when the reporters arrived, the rumors were immediately confirmed as facts. "He's here," someone said, a court clerk up near the bench, and the curious began finding seats. Patrick smiled for the 2 cameramen rushing to meet him by the back door. He was led to the same jury room on the 2nd floor, where the handcuffs were removed. His khakis were an inch too long, so he methodically rolled them up and cuffed them. Carl entered and asked the deputies to wait in the hall. "So much for a quiet little appearance," Patrick said.
"Secrets are hard to keep around here. Nice clothes."
"Thanks."
"This reporter I know from the Jackson paper asked me to ask you..."
"Absolutely not. Not a word to anybody."
"That's what I figured. When are you leaving?"
"I don't know. Soon."
"Where's the girl?"
"Europe."
"Can I go with you?"
"Why?"
"Just want to watch."
I'll send you a video.
Gee, thanks.
Would you really leave? If you had the chance to walk away, to vanish right now, would you do it?
With or without 90 million?
Either way.
Of course not. It's not the same. I love my wife. You didn't. I have 3 great kids. Your situation was different. No, I wouldn't run. But I don't blame you.
Everybody wants to run, Carl. At some point in life, everybody thinks about walking away. Life's always better on the beach or in the mountains. Problems can be left behind. It's inbred in us. We're the products of immigrants who left miserable conditions and came here in search of a better life. And they kept moving west, packing up and leaving, always looking for the pot of gold. Now there's no place to go.
Wow! I hadn't thought of it through a historical perspective.
It's a stretch.
I wish my grandparents had clipped someone for 90 million before they left Poland.
I gave it back.
I hear there might be a small nest egg left over.
One of many unfounded rumors.
So you're saying the next trend will be looting of clients' money, the burning of dead bodies, and the flight to South America, where, of course, there are beautiful women just waiting to be caressed?
It's working well so far.
Those poor Brazilians, all these crooked lawyers coming their way.
Sandy entered the room with yet another sheet of paper for another signature. Trussell is really edgy, he said to Carl. The pressure is getting to him. His phone is ringing off the hook.
What about Parrish?
Nervous as a whore in church.
Let's get it done before they get cold feet, Patrick said as he signed his name. A bailiff walked to the bar and announced that court was about to convene, so please have a seat. People hushed and moved hurriedly for empty spaces. Another bailiff closed the double doors. Spectators lined the walls. Every clerk in the courthouse had business near the bench. It was almost 5:30. Judge Trussell entered with his customary rigid dignity, and everybody stood. He welcomed them, thanked them for their interest in justice, especially at this late hour of the day. He and the district attorney had agreed that a quick hearing would reek of a sleazy deal, so things would proceed deliberately. They had even discussed postponing it, but decided a delay would give the impression that they had been caught trying to sneak something through. Patrick was led through the door by the jury box and stood next to Sandy in front of the bench. He did not look at his audience. Parrish stood nearby, anxious to perform. Judge Trussell flipped through the file, inspecting every word on every page.
"Mr. Lanigan," he finally said, deeply and slowly.
For the next 30 minutes, everything would be said in slow motion.
"You have filed several motions."
"Yes, Your Honor," Sandy said.
"Our first is a motion to reduce the charges from capital murder to mutilating a corpse."
The words echoed through the still courtroom. "Mutilating a corpse?"
"Mr. Parrish," His Honor said.
It had been agreed that Parrish would do the bulk of the talking. The burden would be his to explain to the court, for the record, and, more important, for the press and citizenry listening out there. He did a wonderful job of detailing recent developments. Wasn't a murder, after all, but something far less. The state did not oppose the reduction of charges because it no longer believed that Mr. Lanigan killed anyone. He paced around the courtroom in his best Perry Mason routine, unshackled by the customary rules of etiquette and procedure. He was the spin doctor for all sides.
"Next, we have a motion by the defendant for this court to accept a plea of guilty to the charge of mutilating a corpse. Mr. Parrish?"
The second act was similar to the first, with Parrish relishing the story of poor old Clovis. Patrick could feel the heated stares as Parrish delighted in as many details as Sandy had given them. "At least I didn't kill anyone," Patrick wanted to scream.
"How do you plead, Mr. Lanigan?" His Honor asked.
"Guilty," Patrick said, firmly but with no pride.
"Does the state have a recommended sentence?" the judge asked the prosecutor.
Parrish walked to his table, fumbled through his notes, paced back toward the bench, and along the way finally said,
"Yes, Your Honor, I have a letter from a Ms. Dina Postel of Meridian, Mississippi. She is the only surviving grandchild of Clovis Goodman."
He handed a copy to Trussell as if it were something brand new.
In the letter, Ms. Postel pleads with this court not to prosecute Mr. Lanigan for burning her grandfather's corpse. He's been dead for over 4 years, and the family cannot survive any more suffering and agony. Evidently, Ms. Postel was quite close to her grandfather and took his death very hard.
Patrick cut his eyes at Sandy. Sandy wasn't about to look at Patrick.
"Have you spoken with her?" the judge asked.
"Yes, about an hour ago. She became quite emotional on the phone and pleaded with me not to reopen this sad case. She vowed that she would not testify in any trial, nor would she cooperate with the prosecution in any way."
Parrish again walked to his table and rifled through some more papers. He spoke to the judge but addressed the courtroom.
"Given the feelings of the family, it is the recommendation of the state that the defendant be sentenced to serve 12 months in jail, that the incarceration be suspended pending good behavior, that he pay a fine of $5,000 and all court costs, and be placed on probation."
"Mr. Lanigan, do you agree with this sentence?" Trussell asked.
"Yes, Your Honor," Patrick said, barely able to lift his head.
"It is so ordered. Anything further?"
Trussell picked up his gavel and waited. Both lawyers shook their heads.
"We are adjourned," he said, rapping it loudly.
Patrick turned and made a quick exit from the courtroom. Gone again, vanished before their very eyes. He waited with Sandy for an hour in Husky's office, while darkness settled in and the last of the courtroom stragglers reluctantly gave it up and went home. Patrick was anxious to leave. At 7, he said a long, fond goodbye to Carl. He thanked him for being there, for standing by him, for everything, and he promised to keep in touch. On his way out the door, he also thanked him again for serving as one of his pallbearers.
"Any time," Carl said, "any time."
They left Biloxi in Sandy's Lexus, Sandy at the wheel, Patrick sitting low in the passenger seat, subdued and taking in for the last time the lights along the Gulf. They passed the casinos on the beaches at Biloxi and Gulfport, the pier at Pass Christian, and then the lights spread out as they crossed the Bay of St. Louis. Sandy handed him the phone number and he called her hotel. It was 3 a.m. in London, but she grabbed the phone as if she were watching it. "Eva, it's me," he said with restraint. Sandy almost stopped the car so he could get out while they talked. He tried not to listen. "We're leaving Biloxi now, on the way to New Orleans." "Yes, I'm fine. I've never felt better. And you?" He listened for a long time, his eyes closed, his head leaning back. "What's today?" he asked.
"Friday, November 6th, Sandy said.
"I'll meet you in X at the Villa Galicki on Sunday."
"Right."
"Yes. I'm fine, dear. I love you. Go back to sleep, and I'll call you in a few hours." They crossed into Louisiana in silence, and somewhere over Lake Pontchartrain, Sandy said, "I had a very interesting visitor this afternoon."
"Really, who?"
"Jack Stefano."
"Here? In Biloxi?"
"Yes. He found me at the hotel, said he was finished with the Aresia case and was on his way to Florida for a vacation."
"Why didn't you kill him?"
"He said he was sorry. Said his boys got a little carried away down there when they caught you. Wanted me to pass along his apologies."
"What a guy. I'm sure he didn't stop by just to apologize."
"No, he didn't. He told me about the mole in Brazil, about the Pluto group and the rewards, and he asked me point-blank if the girl Eva was your Judas. I said I had no idea."
"Why does he care?"
"Good question. He said his curiosity has the best of him.
He paid over $1 million in rewards, got his man, but didn't get the money, and he said he won't be able to sleep until he knows."
"I sort of believed him."
"Sounds reasonable."
"He doesn't have a dog in the fight anymore, or something like that, his words, not mine."
Patrick put his left ankle on his right knee and gently touched the burn.
"What does he look like?" he asked.
55, very Italian, lots of groomed gray hair, black eyes, a handsome man. Why?
"Because I've seen him everywhere.
For the last 3 years, half the strangers I've seen in the outback of Brazil have been Jack Stefano.
I've been chased in my sleep by 100 men, all of whom turned out to be Jack Stefano. He has ducked in alleys, hidden behind trees, followed on foot at night in Sao Paulo, tagged behind me on motor scooters, and chased me in cars. I've thought about Stefano more than I have my own mother. The chase is over. I finally got tired of it, Sandy. I gave up. Life on the run is quite an adventure, very thrilling and romantic until you learn that someone is back there. While you're sleeping, someone is trying to find you. While you're having dinner with a wonderful woman in a city of 10 million, someone is knocking on doors, quietly showing your photo to a clerk, offering small bribes for information. I stole too much money, Sandy. They had to come after me, and when I learned they were already in Brazil, I knew the end would come. What do you mean you gave up? Patrick breathed heavily and shifted his weight. He looked through his window at the waters below and tried to organize his thoughts. I gave up, Sandy. I got tired of running and I gave up. Yeah, I've already heard that. I knew they would find me, so I decided to do it on my terms, not theirs. I'm listening. The rewards were my idea, Sandy. Eva would fly to Madrid, then to Atlanta, where she would meet with the boys from Pluto. They were paid to contact Stefano and handle the flow of information and money. We milked the money out of Stefano and eventually led him to me, to my little house in Ponta Paran. Sandy turned slowly, his face blank, mouth open and crooked to one side, his eyes vacant. "Watch where you're going," Patrick said, pointing to the road. Sandy jerked the wheel and brought the car back into the right lane. "You're lying," he said without moving his lips. "I know you're lying." "Nope. We collected $1,150,000 from Stefano, and it's hidden now, probably in Switzerland with the rest of it." "You don't know where it is?" "She's been taking care of it. I'll find out when I see her." Sandy was too shocked to say anything else. Patrick decided to help. I knew they would grab me, and I knew they would try to make me talk, but I had no idea this would happen. He pointed to the burn above his left ankle. I thought it might get ugly, but they damn near killed me, Sandy. They finally broke me, and I told them about Eva. By then she was gone, and so was the money. You could have easily been killed, Sandy managed to say. He was driving with his right hand, scratching his head with his left. That's true. Very true. But 2 hours after I was captured, the FBI in Washington knew Stefano had me. That's what saved my life. Stefano couldn't kill me because the feds knew about it. But how Eva called Cutter in Biloxi? He called Washington. Sandy wanted to stop the car, get out and scream, lean over the side of the bridge, and let flow an endless string of blue profanities. Just when he thought he had been clued into Patrick's past, this latest twist came crashing in. You were a damned fool if you let them catch you. Oh, really? Did I not just walk out of the courtroom a free man? Did I not just talk with a woman I love dearly, a woman who happens to be keeping a small fortune for me? The past is finally gone, Sandy. Don't you see there's no one looking for me anymore? So many things could have gone wrong. Yeah, but they didn't. I had the money, the tapes, the Clovis alibi, and I had 4 years to plan everything. The torture wasn't planned. No, but the scars will heal. Don't ruin the moment, Sandy. I'm on a roll. Sandy dropped him off at his mother's house, his childhood home, where a cake was in the oven. Mrs. Lanigan asked him to stay, but he knew they needed time alone. Plus, he hadn't seen his wife and kids in 4 days. Sandy drove away, his brain still swirling. Chapter 43. He awoke before sunrise, in a bed he hadn't slept in almost 20 years, in a room he hadn't seen in almost 10. The years were distant, another lifetime. The walls were closer together now, the ceiling lower. Over the years his things had been removed, the boyhood memorabilia, the saints' banners, the posters of blonde models in tight swimsuits. As the product of two people who rarely spoke to each other, he had made his room his sanctuary. He'd kept the door locked long before his teen years.
His parents entered only when he allowed them. His mother was cooking downstairs. The smell of bacon drifted throughout the house. They had stayed up late. Now she was up early, anxious to talk. And who could blame her? He stretched, slowly and carefully. The crusted skin around his burns cracked and pulled. Too much of a stretch, and the skin broke, and the bleeding started. He touched the burns on his chest, desperately wanting to dig in with his fingernails and scratch with a fury. He crossed his feet and locked his hands behind his head. He smiled at the ceiling, an arrogant smile because life on the run was now over. Patrick and Danilo were gone, and the shadows behind them had been destroyed in a crushing defeat. Stefano and Aricia and Bogan et al., and the feds and Parrish with his insipid little indictment, all had been laid to waste. There was no one left to chase him. Sunlight eased through the window, and the walls inched together. He showered quickly and treated his wounds with a cream and fresh gauze. He had promised his mother some new grandchildren, a fresh batch of them, to take the place of Ashley Nicole, a child she still dreamed of seeing again. He told her wonderful things about Eva and promised to bring her to New Orleans in the very near future. No definite plans to get married, but it was inevitable. They ate waffles and bacon and drank coffee on the patio as the old streets came to life. Before the neighbors could begin stopping by to applaud the good news, they left for a long drive. Patrick wanted to at least see his city again, if only briefly. At 9, he and his mother walked into Robilio Brothers on Canal, where he bought new khakis and shirts and a handsome leather travel bag. They ate beignets at Café du Monde on Decatur, then a late lunch at a nearby café. They sat at his gate at the airport for an hour, holding hands and saying little. When his flight was called, Patrick hugged his mother tightly and promised to call every day. She wanted to see the new grandkids, and quickly, she said with a sad smile. He flew to Atlanta. Using his legitimate Patrick Lanigan passport, given to Sandy by Eva, he boarded a flight to Nice. He had last seen Eva a month earlier, in Rio, over a long weekend in which they spent every moment together. The chase was almost over, and Patrick knew it. The end was near. They clung to each other as they walked the crowded beaches of Ipanema and Leblon, ignoring the happy voices around them. They had late, quiet dinners in their favorite restaurants, Antiquarius and Antonio's, but they had little appetite for food. When they spoke, the sentences were soft and short. The long conversations ended in tears. At one point she had convinced him to flee again, to leave with her while he was still able, to hide in a castle in Scotland or a tiny apartment in Rome where no one would ever find them. But the moment passed. He was simply tired of running. Late in the afternoon, they rode a cable car to the top of Sugarloaf Mountain to watch the sunset over Rio. The view of the city at night was spectacular, but difficult to appreciate under the circumstances. He held her closely as the wind chilled them, and he promised her that some day, when it was all over, they would stand in this exact spot and watch the sunset and plan their future. She tried to believe him. They said goodbye on a street corner, near her apartment. He kissed her on the forehead and walked away into the crowd. He left her crying there because it was better than a messy scene at the crowded airport. He left the city and flew west, changing flights as the planes and airports got smaller. He arrived in Pontoporan after dark, found his Beetle parked where he'd left it at the airport, and drove the quiet streets to Huachiridentes, to his modest home, where he arranged his things and began his wait. He called her every day between 4 and 6 p.m., a coded call with different names. And then his calls stopped. They had found him. The train from Nice arrived in Aix on time, a few minutes after noon Sunday. He stepped onto the platform and looked for her in the crowd. He didn't really expect to see her. He was only hoping, almost praying. Carrying his new bag with his new clothes, he found a taxi for the short ride across town to the Villa Galicki on the edge of the city. She had reserved a room in both names, Eva Miranda and Patrick Lanigan. How nice to be in from the cold, to travel as real people without the cloak and dagger of false names and passports. She had not checked in yet, the clerk informed him, and his spirits sank. He had dreamed of finding her in the room, adorned in soft lingerie, ready for intimacy. He could almost feel her. "When was the reservation made?" he asked the clerk, irritated.
"Yesterday. She called from London and said she would arrive this morning. We haven't seen her."
He went to the room and showered. He unpacked his bag and ordered tea and pastries. He fell asleep amid dreams of hearing her knock on the door, of pulling her into the room. He left a message for her at the front desk and went for a long walk through the lovely Renaissance city. The air was brisk and clear. Provence in early November was delightful. Perhaps they would live there. He looked at quaint apartments above the ancient narrow streets and thought, yes, this would be a nice place to live. It was a university town where the arts were revered. Her French was very good, and he wanted to become proficient. Yes, French would be his next language. They would stay here for a week or so, then go back to Rio a while. But maybe Rio wouldn't be home. Flush with freedom, Patrick wanted to live everywhere, to absorb different cultures, to learn different languages. He was set upon by a pack of young Mormon missionaries, but shook them off and walked along the Cour Mirabeau. He sipped espresso at the same sidewalk café where they had held hands and watched the students a year earlier. He refused to panic. It was a simple matter of a late connecting flight. He forced himself to wait until dark, then strolled as casually as possible back to the hotel. She wasn't there, nor was there a message. Nothing. He called the hotel in London and was informed that she had left yesterday, Saturday, around mid-morning. He went to the terrace garden next to the dining room and found a chair in a corner, which he turned so he could watch the front desk through a window. He ordered 2 double cognacs to fight the chill. He would see her when she arrived. If she'd missed a flight, she would have called by now. If she'd been stopped by customs again, she would have called by now. Any problems with passports, visas, tickets, and she would have called by now. No one was chasing her. All the bad guys had been either locked up or bought off. More cognac on an empty stomach, and before long he was drunk. He switched to strong coffee to stay awake. When the bar closed at midnight, Patrick went to his room. It was 8 a.m. in Rio, and he reluctantly called her father, whom he'd met twice. She had introduced him as a friend and a Canadian client. The poor man had been through enough, but Patrick had no choice. He said he was in France and needed to discuss a legal matter with his Brazilian lawyer. Apologies for disturbing him at home so early, but he couldn't seem to locate her. It was an important matter, even urgent. Paolo didn't want to talk, but the man on the phone seemed to know a lot about his daughter. She was in London, Paolo said. He had talked to her on Saturday. He would say nothing more. Patrick waited 2 agonizing hours, then called Sandy. "She's missing," he said, now very much in a panic. Sandy had not heard a word from her. Patrick roamed the streets of X for 2 days, taking long, aimless walks, napping at odd hours, eating nothing, drinking cognac and strong coffee, calling Sandy and scaring poor Paolo with repeated calls. The city lost its romance. Alone in his room, he wept from a broken heart, and alone on the streets, he cursed the woman he still madly loved. The hotel clerks watched him come and go. At first he was anxious as he asked for his messages, but as the hours and days passed, he barely nodded at them. He didn't shave, and he looked tired. He drank too much. He checked out after the 3rd day, said he was going back to America. He asked his favorite clerk to keep a sealed envelope at the desk in case Madame Miranda appeared. Patrick flew to Rio. Why, he wasn't sure. As much as she loved Rio, it would be the last place she would be seen. She was much too smart to go to Rio. She knew where to hide and how to disappear and how to change identities and how to move money instantly and how to spend it without drawing attention. She had learned from a master. Patrick had taught her all too well the art of vanishing. No one would find Eva, unless, of course, she wanted them to. He had a painful meeting with Paolo, in which he told the entire story, every detail. The poor man crumbled before his eyes, crying and cursing him for corrupting his precious daughter. The meeting was an act of desperation and utterly fruitless. He stayed in small hotels close to her apartment, walking the streets, once again looking at every face, but for different reasons. No longer the prey, he was now the hunter, and such a desperate one at that. Her face would not be seen, because he'd taught her how to hide it. His money dwindled, and he was eventually reduced to calling Sandy and asking for a $5,000 loan. Sandy quickly agreed and even offered more. He gave up after a month and traveled by bus across the country to Pontoporan. He could sell his house there and maybe his car. Together both would net $30,000. Or maybe he would keep them and get a job. He could live in a country he loved, in a pleasant little town he adored. He could work perhaps as an English tutor, live peacefully on Huachitidentes, where the shadows were gone now, but the barefoot boys still dribbled soccer balls along the hot street. Where else could he go? His journey was over. His past was finally closed. Surely, someday, she would find him. This is Frank Muller. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Partner by John Grisham. Production copyright 1997, Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.